courage to tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms, blues, hip-hop, house. WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our winter pledge drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Edwidge Dantakad. Edwidge Dantakad is the author of several books. They include Breath, Eyes, Memory, Crick Crack, The Frame Farming of Bones, Brother, I'm Dying. Her awards include a National Book Critics Circle Award as well as a MacArthur Fellowship. Edwidge Dantakad teaches at Columbia University. Her latest book is We're Alone, published by Gray Wolf Press. It's a collection of 8 essays. Good morning, Edwidge.
Good morning.
So good to see you.
You
know you're my favorite writer.
Oh, you say that to all the writers.
Oh, you know. I've got all your posters here behind me.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay. You know, I want to begin, Edwidge, talking about your last essay, Writing the Self and Others. You mentioned a number of things that I thought would be good to begin our conversation discussing. One, you talk about becoming an elder. What does that mean, and why is that important?
Well, it means, you know, we come from a community, and by we I mean folks in the African diaspora, where we honor our ancestors and those who came before us and paved the way for us. Because it's such an important part of our existence, you know, we have different mottos for it, but because they fought, because they resisted, because they survived, is why we are here. So, so that this idea of lineage is so crucial. It's so important, and there was this moment that, you know, that comes for all of us, where suddenly you're a child, and then you're a parent for some of us, and then you're in the gap of sort of caring for your parents and your children, which has happened to me. And then there was a moment where so many in my parents' generation, you know, my aunts, my parents first, and my aunts started slipping away, and then I realized I had bumped up.
Bumped up, right?
To this position of elder. And then when people, you know, kids and, you know, who you knew as babies start calling you auntie, then you're like, you're definitely an elder.
Right. And it goes with the graying hair.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, you also write in this last essay, you mentioned that you don't write about happy things. Why?
It's almost, you know, it's really not a choice. I felt like that was more of an apology, because people will always say, well, why don't you write some happy things? And I do write some happy things. I think joy is layered. It's nuanced. And but I'm often drawn to the more melancholic things, as I'm trying to understand my way through them. So it's really not a choice. I don't try to write sad things. But I think complex things are often a combination of both happy and sad.
How much is that dependent on community? I mean, we're talking to you today and you're back in New York City. I was wondering in terms, you know, you spent time in, you know, you grew up in Haiti, you spent time in Florida. Has that mood changed because of your location and community?
No, I think, I mean, it's, of course, life itself has that, you know, those waves, right? The ups and downs. And wherever we are, there's joy and sadness in both, right? But I think over time and, you know, over living in different places, what has probably come through with me was, you know, what I carry over from my childhood in Haiti to growing up then in New York and then moving to Florida, all of that and returning back here, all of those journeys. I mean, I think the older you get, so like the more tools we have to examine them, and of course, history and, you know, painful things that are happening at the moment will, you know, affects how we all feel. I mean, you know, even as we brace for very difficult times ahead based on the communities we belong to. So it's very, I think it varies. And actually being in community, being part of a community is one of the things, one of the balms, you know, it's where we find solace, is where we can actually not just address these types of emotions together, but come up with communal actions together.
Let me ask the question in a different way. Same question, different way. If I look at your work, as I say, as a critic, and I'm looking at Haitian American, Haitian writers, how is your work? Where do I place your work? And are there themes within Haitian literature that keep reoccurring?
Well, you know, Haitian literature is so vast and amazing, and often people who are not Haitian or in the Caribbean or experts don't realize that we have a very rich literary tradition, and it, like all, you know, other literature, has a diaspora element to it. But Haitian literature starting with, it can cover things in and out of the, you know, the country, ranging from the indigenous people who were in Haiti, Anacaona, the, you know, who I've written about. It could start there and then goes through this period of enslavement and then through the Haitian Revolution, down to times, you know, the period we're trying to figure out what kind of nation we're going to be, and then through the U.S. occupation, a lot of Haitian literature, like pivotal Haitian literature, grew out of that period with writers.
So then my question would be to you, Edwige, when we look at your work, we were talking about the melancholy and sad.
Yeah.
Is that because of the particular period that you're writing to right now? Where when we look at this continuity, but you went all the way back and it comes up to the present, is there, you know, that's why I was wondering, is there some kind of theme? Let's say this in terms of, you know, one of my mentors was Stephen Henderson, and one of the things that he was addressing was these themes in African-American poetry, that there's a theme of freedom that runs through identity. Okay. So that's why I was wondering, within Haitian literature, is there a constant?
Oh, there would be, I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think the constant would be resistance.
Okay.
Starting through the Haitian Revolution, survival, with work that then takes us through to the earthquake.
Right.
There's often a play. There's also a big tradition of what we call l'audience, which is very joyful, a little jokeful, you know, like.
See how I'm bringing the joy out of you now as you begin to talk?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, the joy is there.
Okay. because you know, I always associate you with joy. You know, that's why, you know, yeah. I might read what you were writing. That's one thing. But when I meet you, there's an element and a grace that you carry, you know, and I think that's very important. If I'm a young writer and I meet you for the first time, I feel I'm motivated to write. And that's
Oh,
why I was just
good. Well,
focusing on that.
yeah, and that's how I feel reading that the sort of the lineage I fall into as well.
Okay. The last thing that in this essay, you write about keeping promises to the dead. Why is that important to you?
I mean, it goes back to this question of, lineage that we've been talking about. And I see, there's some of the work, not to make it sound too lofty, that I see as a kind of offering to those who came before me and in this continuity. But in this very specific context in the essay, that comes from, talking to my uncle, who I came to see right before he took his last breath. We were, was in the room together with him. And he used to always say, "Well, why don't you write about me?" And that's how that conversation came about, like, "I don't write happy things. You don't want me to write about you." And then I said to him, "Well, I'll write about you, don't worry." And then I was able to end this essay. So that was an instance of keeping a promise. And then there are also moments where you break promises, as you know, right? Someone might say, "Don't ever write about me." And
Right.
that makes it even more tempting for you to write about them.
Well, Edwige Dantekat, your mother died in 2014. I know you were very close to her. Talk about your relationship to her, and what did your mother teach you about life as well as death?
Well, I mean, my mother, it was a very interesting journey with my mother because she left Haiti when I was 4, and so I was raised by my aunt and uncle until I was 12, and then we were reunited. And from my whole life, in the kind of framing in my head, I would always think of I had like a regular age, which I'm 55, and then I would subtract those 8 years I was away from my mother that I would call my mama age, like the age that I was with my mother. And right in 2013, where she was sick but didn't know it and came to visit me in Florida, and we found out that she had stage 4 ovarian cancer and had some, thankfully, really some really close time together where she was with me. We were together until for 8 months until she passed. And I had an opportunity to have these extraordinary conversations. My mother was one of those people who said, "Don't write about me." And that's a promise that I broke. But I think she would forgive me. And towards the end, I felt like what I learned, I mean, from her about life and death. First of all, if you ever spend time with someone who is dying, you literally watch things fall away in the way that things that seem so urgent and important. When we're not thinking about mortality, you just slip away, and they're just kind of left with this hyper focus, or at least my mother was, of having important conversations, of making amends, and getting things off her chest. So I learned a lot about that sort of like the this that we have limited time, which we don't always remember, and also that it's just important to as a practice, to allow ourselves to do that, to kind of tell the stories and let some things slip away.
How has your relationship with your mother influenced you in terms of raising your daughters?
Well, I was, part of, I felt like in my mother's dying, she was really giving me parenting advice. First of all, she recorded a cassette full of advice, like, going from, just things to do with the girls, especially going to church was important. And then things to wear to her funeral. She's like, "You better wear a hat and no open-toe shoes." And
Is
I
that linked to
think,
any sort of superstition?
no, not so. I mean, the wear hat was sort of like elegance.
Okay, all right.
It was more about kind of like you can't really be fully dressed for a funeral without a nice black hat. That was how she went to
And
every
the
funeral.
shoes, there's so much,
And
what's it
her
with the
shoes are just
shoes?
like disrespectful if people can see your toes at a funeral. That was her theory. And so, yeah, I mean, she, one of, a very, I don't know, I think it's in The Art of Death that I talk about this moment with her where. I remember, my mother-in-law was around too, and they were the same age, and my daughters were around, and it's really interesting, like when you have someone in a hospital bed, say in a house. My mom was in home hospice, like how if it goes on for some time, it gathers around you, right? People, running around, and so kids play next to the bed. And I remember one time I picked up my daughter, and my mother-in-law was like, "Oh, take it easy, you'll strain your back." And my mom said, "Let her carry her daughter, like she's carrying me." And so it just, and this, I, you know, it was for me, it was such a an honor in a way to kind of usher her, someone out of this world who had ushered you into it. It felt like this the most beautiful gift.
I think is it Myra was one of your daughters?
Yeah, Mira.
Yeah, Mira. Is she, and now you write about, she has an interest in writing, and I was wondering, is that something where you sort of like, okay, don't pursue the career I pursued?
Well, I mean, she does have an interest in writing, not at least for now, not in the public way. Like she writes a lot. She has a lot of, like, she does a lot of journaling, and she took this amazing class that I was able to audit, if you will, with the writer Erica Cardwell, who I've since met and had a beautiful chat with. But yeah, I wouldn't discourage it. I think my girls have no illusion about writing, because they've been able to see how all consuming it is, at least for me, in a way that sometimes is really unhealthy. So I've not had like that closed door policy as a mom writer. Like I try not to disappear behind a door. It's like that sacred thing, mommy's working. I try not to do that. I've always tried to let it flow into my life. Like if they need me, they can come and they can see me working, and they know the intensity of it. So I think they would be making, sometimes people make a choice of their parents' profession out of a kind of romanticism that they have no, they know that sort of the calls and bones of it. And if they, I mean, I don't know that, if they choose it, fine, but they know what it's really like, as opposed to just kind of, pending down great work from up high.
Well, let's talk about you. Let's go from your daughter and let's talk about, say, your students. Okay, and I want to get into Edwards Don got the teacher. In terms of if I was a young person, I signed up for your class, I say, oh wow, this is like taking a course with Toni Morrison. I just wonder, one, is that when you come into that classroom that first time, is there sort of from your students are like, wow, I'm taking this class from Edwards Dondekar. And then the other thing I'm looking at is what are you trying to teach your students? Are there lessons and things that you are you putting emphasis on reading certain writers? How do you deal with a student in terms of pulling out that sense of craft and excellence?
Well, I mean, I think students, and you teach, right? And they're so cool. They're very like level-headed, and I think, and a lot of them, I don't know that everybody in that room comes in and thinking, like has red breath, eyes, memory, or something. For example, I think sometimes they're intrigued by the title, and often, are like, might be surprised by the reading load, or like by some things they're not expecting. But what I try to teach them what I think I learned as an undergraduate who was very, for me, as an immigrant and a child who grew up in Brooklyn and only went, to public schools, someone who this world was very new to me, and very unfamiliar. And so to often when you had a teacher who was friendly, who was accessible, and was really interested in digging deep. That's really what I try to do, in digging deep. So I've taught, so next semester, I'll give you an example of what I'm teaching next semester, a class called Writing in the Presence of Ancestors. And we start out with Toni Morrison's Rootedness from Mary Evans' anthology, where Ms. Morrison sort of talks about what it's like to write in the presence of an ancestor. And then in Zora Neale, in Alice Walker's essay, Looking for Zora. So those are like the two framing texts of our course. And then we pair scholars with the writer. So we read Looking for Lorraine with Imani Perry's book with Lorraine Hansberry, In Search of the Color Purple, Salimishit Attilits with The Color Purple. Just as a way of also of offering models to students about how that could be done, how we can dig very deep into a text and then.
Well, let me interrupt you there, okay? Mm-hmm. And ask you this question. Which text, which book of yours would be the book that you would recommend to a teacher? So, okay, teach this book because this was me at my best. these are themes that I think will help a student understand, say, Alice Walker or Toni Morrison, that this is a book that I feel as a teacher opens the door for saying, okay, it's readable, it's enjoyable, it'll be a sense of surprise, a discovery. Which book of yours would you say covers all of those bases?
I mean, that the book, it would be Brother, I'm Dying, for me, which is my memoir. And it's also the book where people said, if you had written just one, which would it be? And if you know, it's the book that I pass on to young people in my family as a kind of, as a way of, for them to learn both about, you know, the past, distant history, but also the more contemporary history of our family. So, and in a way, it's also a book about writing about family, because I felt like I took on the project of writing that book because my father and uncle, who it's framed around, could not, you know, because they had passed on around this same time. So that would be that. That's it, and it's actually one of the my books that's in the nonfiction.
That's what I'm looking at, because you. I find it interesting that you selected the nonfiction, because still somebody would say, okay, that's your life, and I'm reading my Everything Comes mm-hmm. Life. As opposed to if I'm reading a novel, I'm looking at plot, characters, something that if I'm say, oh, I want to imitate this. I mean, you know, it's storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I would, for in terms of novel, I've been short fiction. I would say Everything Inside, my most recent collection, and then novel like Breath Eyes Memory, because also if you're a young writer, you can see. Also a young person, you know, I started writing that book when I was 18. You can see a young person working her way through thoughts, ideas, how to create characters, how to tell a story. So yeah, Breath Eyes Memory and Crick Crack are in fiction are taught.
Okay, let me ask you a tough question before we take a break. The last time I saw you, you were being honored for being a short story writer. And I was wondering in terms of, you know, somebody would say, okay, when should a novel be a short story, and when should a short story not be a novel? I mean, you make a decision. I know that, for example, sometimes people are writing novels and they know there's another story within there. And then they sort of pull that out. Some short stories give rise to novels and stuff. But I was just wondering, when do you realize, okay, this is a complete unit? This stands by itself.
Well, I mean, I always start, there are things that I think it has a lot to do with the intent, right? There are pieces that, for example, in Creek Crack, there's a story called 1937 that I started, and I think this is it's a short story. And then it was, and then later on, I extended to the farming of bones. And at Everything Inside, there's a story called Seven Stories that was supposed to be my next novel. And I thought, and I was writing, I was loving it. And I had it was the novella length. And then I realized, I'm just writing this because I really enjoy being with these people. So I guess it's a short story. And I mean, I'm realizing, and maybe, I don't know if it's sort of like the way my life has been the last couple of years, a little busy with raising children, or maybe it's just that I'm, and it's interesting being honored for the short story, because I'm like, I'm not a long, I don't write long. And so, and that was reinforced for me. I just finished this book that was like it tried to be long, but it's not long. And so I guess at heart I'm a short story writer, and but I just let the story guide me towards what it wants to be.
Okay. You know, when I read the your first two essays in We're Alone, your new book, it seems that you were becoming more aware of climate change. And I was wondering, how can writers use this issue in fiction or sometimes in terms of using it to affect policy?
I mean, I don't know, the way the world overall, like politically, is moving. I don't know that if we have people who refuse to listen, if we can affect policy as much. I was living in Florida the past 20 plus years, and there was a moment where people couldn't were not even allowed to say climate change in government meetings. That it wasn't just a denial, but it was an enforced denial. And so, but I think, just living in Florida and coming from the Caribbean, more and more you were seeing the effects of it as the water, sometimes, these hurricanes, even like a 2 hour rain would lead to a river in the middle of a city. And you were seeing that gradually happening more. So it was an awareness, that awareness came of living in a place where you were seeing it in real time. And I think that goes to every issue a writer faces. Like we can address it in ways that catch people's attention, either in fiction or nonfiction. But it's like all urgent realities, you have to kind of keep beating that drum until someone pays attention.
I was wondering if you were being affected by the wildfires in LA in terms of, I've been corresponding with friends of mine who are out there and it's been very devastating. I was wondering whether you've been affected by friends who might live in that area.
Yes, I've been talking to some friends as well, some writer friends, and it is. I mean, it's devastating. And yesterday I was reading about that community of Black homeowners who you don't see so much of on the news, right? Who had this, this enclave that just disappeared in the flames. It's one of those. I mean, it's one of many, sadly, urgent realities that we're facing at the same time. And I've seen it in Florida with hurricanes, where suddenly people have to rebuild a whole life, of course, and have lost loved ones. You've seen it. I've seen it through earthquake, devastating earthquake in Haiti, and what it means to have your life changed so drastically in an instant. So it is, it's very hard, and I and the folks in LA certainly deserve our support.
You know, when you say that, I always think of how sometimes you're reading the news. You know, you're reading about the earthquake and say, hey, you're reading about what's going on in Gaza. And then all of a sudden you look up, you're the news. You look up and you were watching television and now you're in living in a tent or you're asking for food and water. And it just shows you how quickly things can change in our lives.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's something that we should never forget. And that's what also art allows us to do, right?
Right.
To slip into that space, to walk in somebody else's skin.
Okay, well, while we're working each other's skin, we're going to take a little break. My guest this morning has been Edwards Dantakar. We're talking about her new book, We're Alone, which was published by Grey Wolf Press. The show's On the Margin. My name's Ethelbert Millen. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of February 3rd, 2025. Thursday, February 6th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the film We Rise for Our Land by award-winning filmmaker Kurt Otebenga Orderson at Bloom Bars, 3222 11th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. More info can be found on www.bloombars.com. On February 8th at 12 p.m., the event I Have a Dream, Celebrating Black Unity Through Poetry and Dialogue, will take place at Busboys and Poets on 235 Carroll Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info can be found on busboysandpoets.com. Finally, in honor of recent events, there will be a Gaza on Our Mind, continuing the ceasefire discussion at Sankofa Video and Books, hosted by Jordan Strudwick. This event will be hosted on Sunday, February 9th, 2025 at 7 p.m. This will be at 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., and more info can be found on www.sankofa.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Edwidge Dantakai. Edwidge, you, water, especially sea and ocean, is a reference that can be found in many of your books. Talk about water as symbol and metaphor, and talk about how trash pollutes our water and how it eventually enters our bodies, because you write about this in your new book, We're Alone.
Well, you know, water, I think, because I was born in an island, has always fascinated me, and water as, you know, it's as a symbol, as a place of cleanse. You know, I'm especially intrigued by rivers, and I can't fully explain it, so like the fascination of it, but in real time, like, you know, we read it, it's in the paper all the time, the, you know, the microplastics, the way that like all the things we're consuming and then putting back in the ocean cycle back to us through the water, through the fish, and all these other sometimes horrific things we've seen of animals being
like whales being opened up. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then there are like these ropes and bottles in their bodies, and even birds now, right, with things they consume thinking are food. So I think it's one of the things that, you know, doing trips to Haiti started catching my attention, where these places that you know, sometimes even remote places, there would be this indestructible trash around that just would be hard to, you know, to let go. And you see that vortex. I'm one of the people kind of who watches that vortex of trash in the middle of the ocean. It all makes you think about sort of like the ultimate destructibility of things, like how as humans, we take a lot for granted, certainly. We think that we put a lot of weight on nature, thinking it will sort of replenish itself. And often people in the most vulnerable places suffer the most from that. So that's one of the things I was trying to explore. But I think we'll all be affected. One of the things when I, you know, as a mother, you know, when I remember reading that some like these microplastics were in breast milk, mm-hmm. and some like these airplane fumes and things that were in the environment when breast milk. So you have an infant who right after being born is already consuming these things. It's alarming.
Right. You know, Edwidge Dantakai, let's talk about the history and stereotyping of Haitians. You know, we can talk about, you know, Black people around the world, but specifically let's talk about Haitians in terms of, has that something that we've seen as an increase? And whether also in your own life, whether in New York or Florida, have you experienced, you know, incidents where it's just very hurtful?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had during this past election cycle, you know, Haitians being used as tropes, you know, for anti-Blackness and xenophobia combined with the instances of, you know, the Haitians, the newly arrived Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, who, by even the governor's account and many local residents, have, you know, brought the town back, been working, buying shut up homes, and but still were accused by the, you know, the administration, incoming administration, to be of eating cats and dogs, right, as a way of winning an election. You know, the vice president-elect said it himself, but that, yes, we said this, we created the story as to get, you know, to get attention. But that's been, that's part of a very long history of demonizing Haiti since the Haitian Revolution, you know, which was considered a terrible example for this slaveholding world, and where these Black people had had overcome the people who enslaved them and started their own nation. That was considered a terrible example for the world, and Haiti had to suffer. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that, that, you know, there was a trade embargo, isolation, and France, this is the 200th anniversary of this, where France forced Haiti to pay a ransom. But another constant way of negating those wins was with disinformation, starting with Thomas Jefferson calling us cannibals, and in the 80s with you know, Haiti, Haitians being labeled as one of the only people by nationality who were said to have brought AIDS to the world. And so that disinformation has never stopped, but it really, with social media, spread so much more wildly and in such a dangerous way during this past election cycle.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because many times when people talk about Haiti, they go back to like the Haitian Revolution, they go back to that. But in my lifetime, you know, the thing I really saw was what you just said about the AIDS epidemic, you know. And then if I'm not mistaken, there's a reference of that in Brother from Another Planet, I mean, the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm saying, okay, now here are movies, you know, which, you know, in the Black community, and with a John Sayles movie in this case. But what happens is that once you put something like that on the big screen, then I'm concerned about films, and then I'm also concerned about comedians who tell jokes, mm-hmm. but it's at the expense of Haitians.
Oh, there was so much of that in the, you know, following in the 80s. I mean, there was even a reference in the film of How Stella Got Your Groove Back, and then it was, and then some of these, you know, jokes on the radio, which the community had to constantly, you know, protest and remark on and resist, and in which the, you know, soon to be again President of the United States keep harping on, like keeps saying, you know, and reinforcing. So even though it's something that, you know, there was a huge march in the 90s on the Brooklyn Bridge in protest against the Food and Drug Administration's ban on Haitians donating blood, even to their own relatives. And that was also part of a movement against that disinformation, but it keeps returning in different ways. And you're absolutely right. That's once something is, you know, is embedded in the culture that way, and now the social media makes it spread harder and last, you know, forever, basically. Once that happens, then you have comedians just or others who can just casually drop it off, because, like, in passing, it could be said as something as though it were sort of commonly accepted knowledge that we can just put in jokes, or we can just randomly say.
And I think my concern is that it's sometimes it's Black on Black, you know, it's mm-hmm. Black comedians using, you know, Haitians as a joke. I want to ask you about one of the things that I feel, you know, we see these, I'm wondering whether there's, we've talked about the earthquake in Haiti, but I'm just wondering whether after earthquakes, this right now, as Trump gets ready to enter the White House again, whether there's tremors going through the Haitian community.
You know, I can't speak for the entire Haitian community, but some of the communities I'm associated with, yes, absolutely yes. I think it's safe to say that there are definitely tremors going through the community in Springfield, Ohio, which was so much in the national spotlight at that, you know, during the election cycle, and that Trump has said that he that would be among the first places where he would start these mass deportations. So I, a lot of people, you know, I have friends and some family members there who moved there very long ago, and they have said that a lot of people have left Springfield, Ohio, for example, in part, you know, there were bomb threats, and you know, who knows what will happen on January 20th in the afternoon, where people might suddenly feel empowered to act themselves on threats of violence, right? And so there's that fear. There's definitely that fear. I think it's especially a lot of Haitian immigrants have moved to the Midwest, often because they're told that's where the jobs are and that's where they're likely to find jobs. So Trump also started mentioning a place in Pennsylvania where there was, you know, at least small town America where sort of immigrants have moved. And so I definitely think there's tremors through that, those communities. And those of us who also, you know, like all immigrant families, and I say family in the broader sense, but also smaller families are mixed status families, right? And Haitian families have that too, where you have people in the family of different status. So there's always that terror of the separations, of the deportations, and what will they look like? You know, my mother, my parents, when they came here, were initially undocumented, and they were factory raids. My mother was once arrested in a factory raid where she was pregnant and kept overnight and like in an immigration jail. So those things might start happening again. So that I certainly have that fear, and so I think it's something that is definitely. All immigrant communities have it.
Well, you know, I know I'm reading, right. I know I'm reading your book, and you know, you can talk about this because of what you've done. We talk about deporting people, but before people are deported, they're detained. They're in detention camp. You've visited some of these detention facilities. Talk about that experience.
Oh yeah, I mean, folks may not realize how far these detention facilities were. You know, ever since like. I remember when I was when I came to the U.S. at age 12, but when I was about 14, my dad was a deacon in a church, and we would sometimes in Sunday afternoons visit the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was used as a detention facility when Rudy Giuliani was Attorney General but he was Attorney General either of New York or of the United States, and would go down to Haiti and say, you know, visited with a baby doc, and he would come back and say, oh, he told me there's nothing wrong with what's going on. And so they would detain people who were claiming asylum from the dictatorship, and some would come by boat and were detained at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And then I've visited detention centers in Miami.
Wasn't Guantanamo at one time used for detention of the Haitians?
Yes, that was the first time it was that, you know, used for detention of Cubans and Haitians, and who, in a way, it was a kind of precursor to what it's used for now. But about 40,000 Haitians went through Guantanamo, living behind barbed wire. Mm-hmm.
Let me mention the other thing I've been following, and you correct me if I'm wrong. I was talking to a friend of mine about deporting, say, Haitians, that because of the status of the Haitian government or lack of government, that it's easy to do, because in some countries, a country could say, we refuse to accept back. But in the case of Haiti, there wouldn't be any refusal.
Yes, because they have, I mean, there's a very sort of strange structural government right now where they have an alternating head of state and with a prime minister. And, you know, they don't really have the power to say, no, we won't accept. There are places in Latin America and Central America that have done that. And actually, one of the things that this incoming borders are, so-called borders are, has said is that they would penalize. They've always threatened to do that, that they would penalize people that refuse to accept them. But there is a, there's supposed to be a procedure. But, you know, deportations have been, even through this, there, you know, the Biden administration has been deporting, I think, as recent as last week, people. And sometimes they'll deport them because they can't deport people to Port-au-Prince. They'll deport them in the, to the north in the Cap-Haïtien, where then the people have to find their way back to where they're from. So there, we also have to, you know, be aware that that's something that never did stop. But the very specific focus of, like, this idea of, you know, that now what's being framed as these mass deportations seem like they would be going back to the brutality and the inhumanity of it, and the numbers certainly is what they're threatening to increase.
You know, when one picks up the newspaper or even follow the news in terms of what CBS stream or on television, when there's a reference to Haiti, it's a reference to the gangs, okay, the gangs in Haiti. And you never, trying to figure out, okay, what's driving the gangs? Okay, what's this about? Is this about drugs? This, I just hear gangs, you know, and it makes no sense. And then they give me a name, like, okay, this person's barbecue or whatever, you know. Yeah. And so what happens, I don't get a sense of what's going on. It's very confusing. And it's just saying gangs. What is that about? Mm-hmm. I mean,
these armed groups who are now more like paramilitaries than gangs, like, right? Gangs suggest some inner city youth.
Your turf wars.
Exactly.
West Side Story.
Exactly. This is not what's happening here. These are very carefully armed, very armed, sometimes more, you know, armed than the police. Paramilitaries, really, groups that are funded by politicians and oligarchs, very rich people in Haiti, sometimes business people, for their own interest. So in the past, they might have been armed, you know, some politician might have gone what they call the popular areas, but these underprivileged areas, and giving young people guns to try to, you know, discourage people to go vote, or for some business interests, for some personal reasons. But gradually they became more, these armed groups became more powerful by, you know, perhaps through the drug trade. You know, there's one very, people often talk about barbecue, but there's also this other group led by this guy named Izo, who is now has among its members someone who used to work for the government, right, who is accused of one of the suspects in killing the president, but is allied with this group, had ties with Colombia. And so there might also be connections to the drug trade. So it's not young people in the inner city who've lost their way. It's really paramilitaries who are armed and supported by very powerful.
Well, look what you just said, Dante. We're writers. Just by changing the terms, okay, from gangs to paramilitary, that's a completely different situation. You know, we're dealing with paramilitary. If I'm a Kenyan official, I'm like saying, you know, I can deal with gangs, but I don't know if I want to send a police department from Kenya to deal with paramilitary groups. I can deal with a gang, but if you're saying what the language is that how we discuss the issues, going from gangs to paramilitary, it shows you a different type of response is needed.
Well, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not a unique observation. Others, like, you know, scholars like Jimmy Mapierre and others who've studied the situations have said it. And even these groups, they'll make videos of themselves with, you know, with their guns, with their, you know, they're highly produced. And it's clear, some of them have said it, they have contact and they've named names of people in the government that they've been, that they were, or politicians that have started them down this path. And some of them think of themselves as writers. They have, like, rappers. They have drones. They have, I mean, it's just very, it's a very complicated situation that is absolutely more complicated than, say, than gangs.
Well, you know, when you go back, and we're moving towards the end of our program, Edwidge Dantica, but when we go back, one of the things that's always seems to be like haunting a response is the fact that historically, we can go back to the period Woodrow Wilson of people intervening. You know, we can go back even after earthquake where, you know, cholera spreads because people had intervened into the country. So it seems if any type of help, even if it came from Kenya, there is this historical framework which says we don't want anybody to come into Haiti, even if it's trying to resolve certain issues. Is that a problem?
Well, I mean, there's such a long and painful history of intervention, right, where the intervention has aggravated the problem. You know, the example, you know, going back to the U.S. Military intervention in 1915 to 1934, and, you know, 2004, you know, which continued through the cholera, right, the U.N. and all this money spent. And I think in this recent in intervention, people kept saying, right, like reinforce the institutions, right? You give the Haitian police more, some of this. And we've had these very conflicting stories about the, you know, like the what the Haitian police continue their struggle, right? They're in the and sometimes backing up the Kenyans who are less familiar with the terrain. So it's a matter of figuring out also how best to empower people with ways to uplift themselves. You know, it sounds very, very simple, but it, these often these outside interventions, especially in this in these very intense moments, don't always work in the way that they're intended to do. I don't think we can. It's very, I think we can't also exempt ourselves and the leaders that we have because they also should be doing more, right? They should be more of a sense of urgency in terms of what they need to do because we have a million people displaced, some of my relatives among them. We have all these violence against women. We, you know, we have a capital city that's basically surrendered to these armed groups and paramilitaries. So there should also be on the, you know, among the people who are our so-called leaders, like more urgency. And I know there, but there are so many groups who are fighting hard to save this country. That's also the story we do not see. There are a lot of people who are working hard against odds, both from the outside and on the inside, to try to rescue this place that means so much, that is so important, I think, to the world. But I think we also have to keep in mind those people who are very well-intended and very people who are working really hard in the country to bring about change.
Well, I know, Edwidge, I know, Edwidge, that you are a person working very hard and that your work inspires many, you know, Haitians as well as non-Haitians. And I always respect you in terms of not making you a spokesperson, but sometimes I realize that when we look around the world, the term that we should see ourselves is that we're survivors, you know, and in this case, you know, we have a responsibility to speak as witnesses, to say, okay, this is what happened, and to make sure it doesn't happen again. So I as I said before, you're my favorite writer. You know, you think that I'm just making that up, but I want to end on that note that my guest today has been Edwidge Dantica. We were talking about her new book, We're Alone, which is a Gray Wolf Press book. My name is Ethbert Miller. The show's On the Margin, the station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Thank you.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack. All one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Georgetown University professor Maurice Jackson and NEA jazz master Willard Jenkins will interview each other about their books, as well as sign them, at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, February 11th at the Hill Center at 921 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. This is the third session of the series, Our City, Our Music, Our Writers. Details at hillcenterdc.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Whether it's the courage to tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms, blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social